welcome back to the Research VR Podcast, everyone, the podcast about the science and design of virtual reality. I'm your host, Oswald Abanyan, and with me today is special guest, Thorama Dorvilius, CEO and co-founder of D-Bias VR. And with me, of course, is Peter Lekhoff, beaming in from Germany.
Well, hello, hello. As usual from virtual reality, we are not eager to take any challenges to make sure we are all in one virtual space, having a wonderful conversation we stream out.
So, Thorama, you started a D-Bias VR in an Oculus Launchpad program. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, D-Bias is a startup that I started probably after we found out we won. this is the name of the startup.
Nice.
And yeah, the app that we created was at that time called Teacher's Pet. And me and Jessica Outlaw, who's a VR behavioral researcher, and she does a lot of really cool work doing surveys and stuff like that with VR.
Had her on the podcast, actually.
Yeah. Okay, cool. I actually heard that. That was the one. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That was cool. Sweet. Yeah. So,
Peter, yeah. What episode?
I think it was
that?
Like 3 or 4 or 5 episodes ago. It was about women in VR, right?
The survey she did.
Research with.
It was pretty good.
Yeah.
Research with Pluto VR, I think, for women in VR. Cool. Yeah. Well, it sounds like you guys are like really. You guys are doing a lot of research that people haven't been doing in the space when it comes to just the social issues that we've been trying to face.
Yeah. That's how I discovered VR in the first place. Like, I did my master's in interaction design at the University of Arts London, and I had, it was a very technical course. It was very, it was research driven and very much practice led and very technical. And I just remember I had like this assistant professor who would just constantly underestimate me and make it very clear that he just had no faith in my like technical abilities whatsoever, to the point where it really started affecting me, because and his behavior towards me was just, it felt like I was a second class student. And
like, really? That was so much backlash from your professor?
Oh my gosh, like within the first month for our first project, so mind you, he does not know me at all. And I had submitted, at that time I had been working as a front-end developer freelance for about a year and a half. I had to submit a portfolio when I had applied for the course. And so I was assumed that they were familiar with my technical work before accepting me. And I just remember for our first project, we all had to talk to him about like what we wanted to do for, like, we had to pitch a proposal to him. And he not only waited till I was last, which is fine, like that was not the problem. But when he came to me, he had spent like an hour with each student. And when he came to me, he was like, okay, I only have 10 minutes. What did you want to do? Blah, blah, blah. And I tell him, I was like, oh, I want to like hack a Kinect and like use motion sensors. And like whenever it reads movement in a certain way, like to manipulate this digital image that looks like it's a painting on the, like have it projected onto the to the wall. And he was like, oh, no, that's going to be too complicated. And I was like, oh, it's okay. I was like, I'm American. I was like, it's fine. I'm not afraid of complicated. And he was like, I'm afraid of complicated for you. And I was like, oh, wait. And I didn't get it what he meant at that point, because I had like in my head, I was like beast mode. Like, like there was no such thing. I had never really, I was not expecting that at all. And I remember talking to friends after saying that he said that. And they're like, oh, he said that to you? And like, and when they reacted, I was like, oh, shoot, I didn't realize like what that actually meant. And then from there, that was my entry to that kind of behavior. Like, and then he just went, it just went downhill from there. Like I was one of the only students in my class to make my project technically work on our demo day. And he was being super nitpicky, trying to find ways to like undercut me, give me like a low grade. And I just remember being like, wow, he's really, really not like, not only did he not help me at all, or he would like ignore me in the class, but like, he almost seemed like to be vested in me not performing well. It was like almost like he knew he had this assumption, and because I proved him wrong, he didn't want to admit it. And so therefore he was trying to find ways to justify his initial feelings versus like accepting that he might have made a mistake in underestimating me or what. And that's also very research driven. That's actually a huge, that's something I learned doing this work then. All that being said, because it was getting so bad and I was trying to tell the professors, the administration, like, hey, he's treating me differently. He's saying things. He's gotten very verbally caustic. Sometimes on the day that he was supposed to check out our projects, he would ignore me completely. He wouldn't come check out my project, but that was the day for him to come see it. And how was I supposed to get graded? Like, if you don't, so things like that happened a lot. And at that point, I was deciding to quit my course because I wasn't being able to get the help that I needed to kind of hold him accountable to that behavior. The professors thought maybe I was being dramatic, or that I was being paranoid, or they were friends with him as well. So they didn't want to see him like get in trouble. So instead it kind of turned on me. And so like I was being the bad seed or whatever. And so at that point I was deciding to quit. And then our course professor came in and he was like, okay, for your master's thesis, for your research thesis, the theme I'm going to give you guys is solve a social problem with technology. And so at that point I was like, okay, well I could quit and then I'd have to leave London, which would suck, but, or I could use this to try and solve this type of problem. And so then that's when I began researching what was happening, and I started coming across terms like microaggressions and like unconscious bias. I didn't know those words existed. I didn't even know what that was. Implicit, I just thought it was like stereotyping and like whatever. And like, so once I started getting the language behind it, once I saw the word empathy and how that was a potential solution for debiasing or reducing bias, I Google searched it and saw Chris Milk's talk on using virtual reality for empathy. It was a TED talk they had done at that time. And this is 2015. So I think that had just came out. This is June or July 2015. And I think that video came out March, like only a couple months prior to that. And so that's when I was like, oh, okay, I think that I have the answer here in terms of being able to create something where I can force, like he became my case study, that teacher, like would something like him taking on being in this tool be not only engaging for him, but like where he's not going to be whatever scared about it, but could I create an experience for him to be introduced to another perspective that would make him believe it, or that would develop his empathy? So that was my original introduction into virtual reality, and then building that out, what that would look like. And then from there, history happened. Mm-hmm. But yeah. Sorry.
What was your question? My question is basically regards the motivation of this professor. So from my perspective and from my life experience, I had multiple situations were definitely not as severe, but similar in a sense that I had really, I was really motivated. And I was kind of really eager to do something, but there were certain people from school, from university, from work environment that were just basically not believing me, not putting faith in me, and rather having a negative bias towards me. However, there were also certain situations where people were, surprisingly to me, way more optimistic than I would expect them to be, and they would basically mentor me and grow this extensive need to do difficult stuff. And particularly in the VR community, it was very empowering because in the beginning I didn't know much, but everyone was just putting faith in me and allowing me to grow. And what I'm trying to go there with that statement is, do you think his motivation was just very easily explainable because you're maybe a woman in tech, or maybe he had some other predisposition regards you, or maybe you think he was just having his experience a professor and was just biased in the way he thinks. So what do you think his core motivation was? Because I think this is very important to understand.
Yeah. I came into it not knowing. I had career transitioned into front-end development, and I had been working independently. So I never worked for a company or with a team. I had worked directly with clients. And so my esteem and my technical capability, like my belief in that, came from making my clients happy. So I came into that course already having a really positive, like being very confident in my skill set. And I was not familiar at all with bias and what that looks like as a woman. Like I didn't have that, pre-awareness. So when that started happening in the beginning, I actually didn't know what that was. I was definitely not the only woman in the class. Half the class was women. So, but what was happening was I was the only one being treated this way. I was the only person of color. And I didn't know, again, in the beginning, I was like, I didn't assume it was because of my skin color or because I was a female. I just assumed that maybe because I have a very bubbly personality as well. But then I did. I was like kind of goofy. And so like, I was like, oh, maybe. And then plus I'm American. So I was like, maybe he just thinks like he can't take me seriously.
This is graduate school, right?
This is graduate school. Yes.
This is grad. Like, that's insane. The app is obviously geared towards like school, like elementary school, middle school.
Yeah.
Like teachers and whatnot. But like you think it by graduate school, like you have proven enough, you've gone through enough like rungs in the ladder and done enough years of school that, you know, you only go into graduate school if you know this is exactly what I want to be doing. You know, it's not just a stepping stone in school. So I think that's
That was something that I didn't understand either. Yeah. It was like, I don't understand where it was coming from. And it wasn't until there were certain occasions when I started I started saying, calling him out, then he would respond like, oh, no, you didn't. Like, he would do like the stereotypical like black girl snap thing, even though that's not what at all what I did or what I talk like. And that's when I knew it was associated with me being a quote unquote African American, and whatever traits he has assigned to me as a woman with that was what was making it really hard for him to see me as technically adept. So once that happened, I knew that it had to do with my physical, who I was, like biologically, more than it had to do with anything else. And he would do that regularly, and it was it was just really, really bad. Yeah. But in his case, yes, that's what I
want to. Yeah. Well, actually, I want to first say interaction design, graduate school, and VR. That's our jam right here. Especially we both come from cognitive science, and you, like, I was really into user design, especially going through college, and VR kind of came in at the same time, where so much of like the neuroscience that we were learning tied in to the VR research that was being done, and so we're always like happy to see people that are actually taking literal research and trying to apply it.
Yes.
In an applicable sense.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about your app actually. Or you submitted, I'm guessing you and Jessica were working together on a project that Oculus Launchpad funded.
Yeah, so they've taken 100 devs for the program, and what they do, it's a competition. So they give you enough resources and tools to get you started, and then you have about 12 weeks to 15 weeks to build something. And then at the end of that 3 months, or almost basically, you submit it to the Oculus store, like, or the Alpha channel. And then whoever, they have a team inside Oculus who reviews all the apps, and then they grade you. I think they grade it on three different metrics, or there's three things they're looking for that they make transparent on their application website. And I don't ask me to repeat it now, but it's like something like 33%. Is it technically great? 33%. Is it an original idea? And 33%, maybe like teamwork or something. I don't know. And if you meet those marks and they like it, you become they'll fund you. They'll give you a certain amount of money with the award to build it out. And then you have like about 6 months from there to get it onto the store. So we were one of the lucky ones last year. Yeah. I think there was 13 of us who won, and that includes me and Jessica. Jessica were really surprised. I was working full time at this point. Yeah. I had a fellowship at Code for America. And so I was actually flying back and forth between Alaska and San Francisco a lot, because I was working with my project was over there. And so I had my weekends, and I took a week off of work a week before the deadline to really polish the prototype, even though it's really
what was the prototype?
The prototype was a very ugly version of what we have now. It was basically you wake up inside a space station, and it's a research lab in space, and you get greeted by these very, very ugly, uncanny valley like humanoids who are your research hosts. And they talk to you and they kind of give you an introduction of what the experience looks like. And then you can, around the space station, there's different booths that you can click on, and then you get teleported into a simulation. That simulation, at that point, I had two simulations that were available, and it was one where you can take a test. You get teleported into this like classroom environment where you have two kids sitting in front of you, and you get asked these series of questions, and you have to pick a student to answer it. And then from there, we tried to show the function, like, that you could be able to capture who we choose and what types of questions did we choose those questions for assigned to the student. And in that case, it was done by race. And this was on the research that teachers will usually have lower expectations of students based on skin color. I think white teachers are 30% less likely to assume a black student will go to college. More than other teachers. And so we were like, okay, how do we address that? And Jessica has a daughter who's half Black. And so she was really concerned about this. This project was close to her heart. And this was actually her idea to try and solve for this, because she had, having reading that research, was really worried that her daughter wouldn't get the best quality of care. And then the second simulation was like, you go into this full classroom and you have a classroom full of kids that can raise their hands and you can low level interact with them. And that was just more of a demo, just to see, to give a feeling of being immersed in a full size classroom. Because while the testing only had two students, it didn't really have the feeling of like, I'm in a classroom. It didn't have like the wow factor. So I just created that just so, so people could see like, oh, this is what it would be like to have a full classroom in here. And like what would an interaction could look like and feel like in terms of like proving the concept of having a simulation with a full class, what would that look like? So, yeah, so that's what we submitted. Yeah.
And after you submitted it and I guess it was accepted and you launched the store, what was the reaction? Because while I'm totally sharing the assumptions that this app has, I know that this topic itself is rather very, very debated, right? So there are people who are hard die saying that there are no microaggressions, there is no assumption, we are a perfect society. And yes, there are obviously people who are pointing out that there are some issues, and I myself think there are some issues. However, what was the reaction in general to this app or to this experience?
Yeah. So we put down a more polished version, complete with the IAT test in there. So it's a very extremely research-driven. Like I said, there's nothing in this app that isn't research, like that it doesn't have an article citing a credible source, or if not a few articles citing that this is what it's for, like what to do. So when we put it on the store.
Would you like to introduce what the IAT test actually is?
Yeah. So the game is now called Teacher's Lens. And the IAT test is what we use. It covers two things. The first thing you're going to learn and we used, again, a research-driven devising protocol. and the first thing is people need to understand what their biases are or what biases is and how it impacts our interactions. The second stage is you can take a test to identify where you're at. So it's the same thing like creating like a health regimen. If you know you're going to go into a diet or you need to have a scheduled plan, the first thing you do is understand what food is healthy and what's not. And then the second part, you take a diagnostic test to understand where your body is at. So that way you can formulate a strategic exercise regimen that will work tailored to you. So we knew it was really important for people to be able to do that. And the IAT test is one of the most definitely controversial, but also one of the most highly researched tools out there to really measure our cognitive associations. And that is basically a test that Harvard created, I think with psychologists, and I think they partnered up with Columbia professors as well as some other universities that were, and they designed a test, I think it was in the 1960s and 70s, it took about 20 years, that could, you take online, you go to this website, and you can, there's, the test will be able to measure different types of associations that we might have. And that's basically like with race, with gender, and all that kind of stuff. So one of the most common ones is the race test. And that's basically you see a face and it'll be Black or white. And then it'll tell you when you see that face to select E for putting it in the bad category, or it'll tell you to select I for putting it in the good category. And so then it'll give you a list of words that are positive associated or negative associated. And then it will tell you to select that word when you see that face come up. So then what it does is when you're selecting, like you say, a negative word comes up, and at that point it's telling you to put negative words with Black faces, and then it'll switch, and then you'll have white faces coming up, and it'll tell you to also select a certain key when it's a white face and a negative word. If we have an unconscious association with associating, like, for example, most commonly with Black people, we'll more associate them with negative traits. It's going to be easier and faster for us to select the negative words when we see their face. But when we see the white face, it'll be slower. There'll be a little hesitation, that kind of a thing. And so the test measures your response time, and it gives you, I think it makes you go through like three different trials and then collects the average. And if there's a significant difference in your average response time when it was a white face and in a Black face, then you can see like, this is where you have a stronger preference for associating this type of word with this type of face.
Right.
Yeah.
I have a question, actually, in terms of the order.
Yeah.
Of, because I know that the testing is switched, right, in terms of like the association of bad words to the race.
Yes.
And I feel like the initial, whichever one you start with first, yeah. Do you think that might have like a certain bias, how imprinted you become in terms of the you know, choosing, you know, the left side, which is like the negative word with a certain yeah. race, and,
yeah.
and having those variables be switched?
Yes. I actually talked about this with another person. We were consulting. I was like, should we have them switch seats? And I think I don't know why. I think the way that we design other this was like 2 months ago, so I forget what the design decision we made then was. But I think for some reason we said, okay, let's go ahead and have them stay in the same seats, just to not introduce any more confusion. But I definitely think the switching sides things is something that I definitely want to look further deeper into. In terms of when you take the IET test, there is no sides. The what they actually have on either side is the good and the it'll tell you what to assign to each category, and that does stay still on either side. But I'm thinking because this is kids, I think at that time we decided because it was consistent with the way the IET test was, and so that's why we left it as is. But I definitely think it would be interesting to see what it would look like if we did have them switch sides. But yeah, and then also yes, there is a.
But I think it creates an average, right? Like that's kind of how a lot of this gets reported, is like the averages of a room or like a class or.
Yes. Certain, yeah. Like you control for basically the position in the class. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Rather than like individual.
Yes. Yeah.
So, but actually, another question. I started trying to do a little bit of research on the subject matter. When people, I feel like, realize that there is unconscious bias, and I think anyone that would deny that to any extent is just, I don't know, denying reality to a large extent. And they need to be more like self aware to really realize that like there's very unconscious biases that we have, whether it's like experience based or even not non-logical based or anything.
Yeah. To not believe in bias is to not believe the question in the brain. And how the brain works.
Yeah, it's to not believe like and how the brain works just evolutionarily, like.
But I think it's hard to accept it.
And obviously like every species.
But I think
has
it's hard to accept it because
it
takes away your full free will and your full rationality, right? So you have to accept a certain degree, which is I think for some people not easy, that they're not fully controlling their decisions and their, you know, their opinions and their thoughts. And I mean, while scientifically speaking, it's absolutely undeniable, I think it's just tough for a lot of people to swallow, right?
Yeah, most people are pretty bad with just like implicitly, you don't know cognitive biases really exist until you kind of study them in a sense.
It's like cognitive dissonance, right?
Yeah, that's true. You know, you change your opinion to match your belief or the other way around as well. But the question I think I was trying to ask is, in terms of quote unquote curing people, or like at least helping move the number and the percentages that we get with implicit association tests, that's considered, you know, improvement, right? And I guess the question is what goes into that, like into actually educating people on, like does education just help?
No. In fact, sometimes that can actually make it worse. Yeah, like a lot of the traditional diversity trainings that happen now are bias trainings. That's exactly how they are. They're kind of lectured style. This is what bias looks like. This is how it acts. And then exactly, I think to Peter's
that's
point a little bit.
Educating of stereotypes, right?
Yes.
Like, that's like,
yes.
If you don't know a stereotype.
Yes.
It's like, oh, like now this is a thing.
Yes.
So I'm talking as an immigrant, like coming into the United States with like not really knowing. You know, like outside of America, it's not the same buildup of people. And so you don't know a lot of the things that are only colloquially American. And or I guess that, yeah. But coming here, you know, you don't know until people tell you. And almost in a sense, like,
so,
we shouldn't almost try to.
Am I understanding you right? That you're basically saying that when you come in and you are not aware of those biases, it's easier for you to ignore them and not, you know, basically be affected by them, whether while you actually are aware of them, it's easier to see them and be affected by those assumptions people have in your behavior.
Maybe, yeah. In the way, I guess I understand bias, but I don't know if this is like the correct research way, but like it would either be based on like biases would be based on either like direct experience with something to then generalize to a bigger group, or to have like a cultural, like, you know, reference or something that is changing your, you know, your action or belief towards someone.
Yeah, I was gonna say, if you it's taking limited information and inferring a truth to it that that may not, that, and you don't realize that it's missing information, or you don't know what you haven't been exposed to counter information. Therefore, that if you draw a false correlation to what one thing happened and what one thing was, and then you infer that this is what it is. But yeah, sorry, I cut you off a little bit too. I think we might be having a little delay with each other. But
yeah, that's the internet, right? Look, we're building virtual reality, but the voice audio still is the whole thing. But I guess, yeah, like, how, if someone takes a test and kind of like realizes that, let's say, they have a severe bias towards one or the other, I guess what does the literature say in terms of building up that? And I guess that also can tie into like de-bias VR, and where you see like the grander vision of what you're trying to do, and how you think you can head towards that.
Yeah. So the IAT test uses, and again, we drew everything from there just because I didn't want to have to defend what we did. So if you want to argue with this test, then argue with them. So the IAT
uses, argue with the researchers.
Yes. Oh, from Harvard. and whatever universities they're at. But so that's little to no preference. Then you have slight automatic preference, then you have moderate automatic preference, and strong automatic preference. So those are that's the scale or the tier. And it's by 0.15, or I think it's 0.15 seconds of a difference that each is scales at with, and if you get a negative or a positive, then it says it'll be usually a negative. It'll fall on the other side. So a slight automatic preference for something that actually might be a bad thing. So if that makes sense.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. What we hope to do after this is basically, I want to do this by the end of the summer, depending on how much time I can commit to creating this, is basically create these debiasing experiences that are gamified. So this is kind of like building again on the research that I did when I was in graduate school, which at that time I had created a prototype that was a game and that incorporated proven debiasing methods in VR, or so far what research was showing to have impact, and then kind of packaging it up into a game. And since it's been a few years now, thank God, and there's a lot more research going on with using a VR and people discovering which ways it's impacting us. Stanford has a really great program, the Virtual Human Interaction Lab, and they did something with the superhero exercise. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, where basically they have people, they did a study where they had people, two different groups. One of them were embodied as a superhero, and the other group was in a third person helicopter helping the superhero. And the mission of that superhero, they had to fly around this abandoned town and find a kid and deliver an insulin shot to them. And what they found was, after they took off both groups took off the headsets, the moderator would like spill a cup of pens on accident, air quotes here. And they counted who from each group got up to help, how fast they got up to help, and how many pens they picked up. And they found that the group that was embodied as a superhero, 100% of them picked up. They picked up a significantly faster rate than the group that was in the third person, and they picked up way more pens. So it kind of was their clue, like, okay, this does have real-world impact for making people feel a lot more helpful. And so we're thinking about, how do we design stuff like that that makes it more accessible? Facebook has an anti-bias training that Harvard just really talked about. And what they do is they have people imagine being on a sports team. And like, for example, if you're white, then all your teammates are black and you have to play against this other team and they're all white. And so imagine playing, imagine when they had them go through this imagining exercise. And I think with VR, what if we just packaged that and actually created an experience where not only if it's fun, you're on a volleyball team. Yeah, yeah.
Now, you remember my question regards the reaction of people. And I asked it exactly because of my second question now. So I'm truly thinking that your app and what you're describing is true. However, let me be the devil's advocate. Would you think that it's easy to get people who are in generally negative framed towards the idea of people having biases? How do you get them inside this app? Because when we speak about Facebook, when we speak about those big giants, when they accept those methods and they actually implement them, well, it's still a very fortunate amount of people who are anyway in the tech industry. But I guess the problem overall in the society is not so much the small tech bubble people are somehow having those biases. It's great if they wouldn't have them. It's great that they train them not to have them. But how would you, or do you think that people who are outside of the tech bubble in general, just normal citizen, would actually by their will and just because they would like to enter this application? So how do you design your application? How do you think to market this application that you're building that is great to actually access or actually to address those people who should benefit most of it?
Yeah, so there's a few things there. One of them, you're talking about society in general. I personally believe, and what I love about as America, that everyone can believe whatever they want and they have the freedom to do it. As long as we respect each other, then go ahead and do what makes you happy. So I'm not here to infringe on that. However, if I walk into a public space, if I'm going to a school and I'm getting services, I think in terms of like education, in terms of the workplace, there are certain rights that that we all have that we need to make sure we protect. So you can have your whatever feelings about me, but as soon as you bring it in to me in the workplace where I'm trying to work and you're making my life a little bit miserable, that's where I think accountability needs to be had and consequences for those actions, because it not only affects me, but it affects the company as a whole or affects the institution as a whole. In the sense, like, for example, in the classroom where you have students who might get over-disciplined, and this is from teachers who might be unconscious about it or conscious about it, whoever knows, but that has long-term impacts. And therefore, I think there should be accountability when that happens. The institution should be making sure that everyone is protected and not harmed from having to experience negative experience just because of something they can't change about themselves, a biological feature. So my app is not for the public. That's however people, society wants to create their own culture. That's up to us as a whole. My app is for institutions where we walk in and we have the right to ensure that we have the best possible means to be successful, whether it's in the classroom or in the workplace or in healthcare. That is, to me, where I think accountability needs to be happened to make sure that everyone is treated equally in those spaces, because that's important. So this app specifically is focused on teachers in the classroom, because I do believe 100%, like, not only should we not be treating students differently because it's going to color gender, but if it has impacts that impact society, our economics, economic society in general, then we need to make sure that we have things in place to protect the students, the children from that.
Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
So the concept sounds like it is built off the idea that visual imagery has a effect on you in terms of like embodying someone, right? Like embodying another person, and if you can close your eyes and visualize that, that is, like, neurologically speaking, almost the same as you actually seeing it. And what you're doing is taking that idea and actually applying it into VR to give you the visual stimulus rather than just imagining it. Embody these. That's actually one of the first researchers that we had covered. You remember, Peter? Like, probably like episode 2 or 3. Was about that, like embodying a different colored avatar was, and standing in front of a mirror have like reduced your score on the implicit association test.
Yes.
I want to say one thing. I'm not a fan of the embodying.
I'm sure you're.
Like,
oh really?
I don't. Interesting. I think that's weird. I don't think, like, I mean, if it works, then it works. But I do think it's a weird way of going about being able to understand someone else as human.
Do you know the rubber hand experiments?
Yeah,
it's basically coming.
Yes.
So for the audience, maybe someone doesn't know it. You basically, when you have phantom lips, you create like a rubber hand, and you touch it, and you hit it with a hammer, and at some point, the brain reacts to it, and it basically forgets that you have the phantom limb.
Wait. You missed the mirror.
Yes, sure.
Mirror that you put your hand and you kind of like almost think your hand is your that rubber mm-hmm. hand by because you start to run feathers in both the exactly. hands at the same time, and then at a certain point they don't rub the same the feather on your real hand and it's on the fake hand, but you still
exactly.
feel that,
but you
right?
can do the same with actually skin color. So there, as far as I remember, it's a study where they were showing on a screen or on a mirror a recording of a basically dark skinned person, and you're a white participant, and they would touch the same parts of your face, and they would touch with some kind of nice foamy thingy on the face on the screen, and this already reduced the implicit biases drastically.
Mm-hmm.
So while your brain can actually, you know, connect in a sense that I could feel the same, it seems to rewire your imagination in a white way. And I think there is also a study regards, for example, how people from Africa smile. They smile with a white smile, and this is in a very intuitive, in a very instinct way for someone from Europe, kind of frightening. So in Europe, you don't smile with a, you know, big grin, and it looks to you more frightening. And the moment you're aware of it, and the moment you try it yourself, you suddenly are more open towards people from Africa. So it's like one of those things that are, you know, there are certain differences between humans,
depends,
and you need to learn.
We're in Europe, yes. right?
And depends where.
I would in general.
Too, I would say.
No, absolutely. I mean, those are old trends. I mean, those are old trends. Those are all statistical correlation between certain things. And they're never like completely true. But why do you think that this embodiment part where you actually play yourself or place yourself in the role of someone else wouldn't be such a good idea?
I think the idea of it feels weird that I would, like, I've never needed to go into a white male avatar to feel like I need to understand, to humanize him. I think there's a lot of different ways to go about it. And I'm not sure what, I have looked at a lot of the different things. And I think there's some, I don't know, I think that also some people get really triggered and they don't like that experience. They get inside. I mean, I've heard from white, like, there's been white guys who wake up and they see themselves as a woman and they actually hate it. And so, like, I think at the end of the day, you're doing something where you're basically taking physical factors, you're putting another person into that physical factors, and you're saying, this is what that person feels like. And I think that's very dangerous, because if they go into that body and they are thinking like that person is like how they think, I think it has a different, that they might make the assumption that that's what the other person is like, or that they miss the whole context of what the experience of being a Black person looks like in America. And or on top of that, like I did see or hear about research that people who had lower self-esteem when they embody a person of color that they do see as a lower value in society or in general, not just a person of color, like that actually triggers it even worse, because it makes them feel like, oh, they're this person. So I just not a fan of that type of, oh, change your body. Like that to me seems, it just seems really like a poor, shallow type of solution that really just feels weird. I like the solutions.
That's
like, the stuff that you're talking about, like how smiling, when they see someone smile and they smile and how that makes it more open. I think the actual encouraging of interpersonal relationships in that kind of way, for me, feels more healthier and feels more less become a Black person. Like I don't know, it just feels less blackface, quote unquote. Like
I got, like, a very good point. I just wanted you to elaborate a little bit more, so I throw in some weird arguments.
And I'm just, that's my answer. And like I think I love that, like that example of like, or being on a team of people who are different from you, it seems more actual real world solution-y, transported but made more accessible in VR, that I think has stronger impacts to debiasing, because that's exactly the same cues that we would take in the real world that would weaken those synapses that have those type of people with certain types of traits when we're exposed to that in the real world. So I want to package those types of experiences as a debiasing game versus,
I have a strange question, and I just want to ask it for the sake of the question. So as far as I remember, one of the big improvements in the fight against racism in US happened after the Vietnam War, right? After people came back from war and they were fighting together with people who were not necessarily same color or same origin, and suddenly they were like brothers to each other, and they came back to a society and figure out, oh my god, well, there is so much things that are going on, let's actually fight it. And another idea that I just had in mind when you were giving your point is, you give two different kinds of color t-shirts to a random group of people, and one part is green, one part is red, and suddenly they consider each other teams. So are you utilizing in your experiences, you know, we are a team together against someone else, and this drives us together?
In that case, like I said, that again, I'm not making up these studies off. I'm not making up these solutions on my head. I'm gonna use what's already out there that's already shown to work. And so in that case, with the volleyball exercise, or I think it's like the sport exercise, yes, it definitely does have. It definitely draws on that human nature kind of principle of if we're on the same team, I'm more likely going to. What is it? Divide and conquer, but in the reverse. Like you can unite the common enemy. Have a common enemy, and then all of a sudden you're bonded. That's definitely one way of approaching it. And I think that approach is great for people who have, let's say, for example, I took the IAT test and I had a stronger bias against Black students or Black people than me being on a team with them and being together. That would be a great solution versus if I had no bias against that or a strong bias the other way, it wouldn't make sense for me to go into that exercise. So these are just solutions that are out there that are like, okay, well, how do we map it to people who might have shown a preference one way or the other, but putting them in the right type of solutions versus just a blanket solution for everyone, I think can be very not thoughtful. It could have other adverse consequences if it's not, looked at, not given, put much thought into it, I think.
I want to ask, in terms of the app, it sounds like you want to deploy it, like go to a specific company and be able to like deploy it within and work with them specific like directly, or maybe not a company but a school, rather than like a general. I'm sure it can be. You released it on the Oculus Home Store, and I got to try it out last night. But it sounds like this is a specific tool you want to use for like an audience.
Yes, exactly. We do have a market that we're trying to look at, and specifically for teachers' lens, it would be, this is our pilot project as DeBias VR. We want to create these healthy, sustainable debiasing protocols using leveraging the power of virtual reality to really make an impact for people to be able to track their progress and their activity and be rewarded by that, and maybe create some incentives where they can have access to peer support through like multiplayer rooms where they can talk to other teachers and see how they can collaborate and solve problems. Like that's like the end goal vision of this. So the first pilot project is with teachers, since we already had that. And we're looking to work with schools or training departments that work with districts and seeing what it would look like to actually implement this VR solution. This is pretty much unprecedented to have a VR training tool for teachers quite yet. Like I think a lot of the VR stuff that's happening for education is more so on the student side. But what would it look like for teachers to have access to Oculus Rift or Vive in their little lobby room where they eat lunch, and then like throughout the day, go ahead and play a couple a game or two and go back to the class, and then also the school to be able to look and see, okay, who's taking the game, which departments are taking the games, and like how are they performing in the games, and then also go back and see like, okay, is student performance actually increasing? Because that's the whole goal of it. If teachers' expectations are the number one factor to determining how well a student do, and our app promises to raise teachers' expectations through that debiasing and also empathy development and gamification, is it actually working? So we would love to like have like a study around it. We'd like to implement it and see what it would look like fitting into the day-to-day of a teacher's schedule without disturbing or being disruptive to their process, and being able to see if it has an impact for what we're promising. So it's holding the product accountable, which I think more bias training solutions need to have. And then eventually, if we can get this model right for education, we'd love to get this right for workplace. We'd love to cross adapt it for there, because I think that's another huge thing in our society that really has larger consequences that are invisible, but really do make a strong impact, specifically economically, and just equity in general on that financial case. So I'm personally vested in the workplace. That was where my first research was. But since we made it this far on the teacher's lens, it's like, well, might as well cross the finish line, and then see how much of it we can transfer into the workplace scenario.
And coming back to your experience that you described in the beginning, do you think that your application you have developed could help this teacher who was not particularly believing in your technical abilities to understand that his point might be faulty, or maybe it would not be his motivation, but his colleagues would say, okay, we actually see that there is something going on. We are kind of more on your side, but maybe you should try this application, figure out for yourself. Do you think it would actually improve and change the overall story development?
If he was taking this app prior to even when we met, I think I definitely would have had a different interaction with him.
Nice.
I think he would have been more mindful of who he was choosing. And that's what we're seeing people doing right now already. When they take the IAT test and then they go into the classroom simulation, they're already like, oh, I need to pay attention to who I'm talking to, blah, blah, blah. Like, I think it's already creating that. It's almost like a preventative tool that I think that interactions would have been, our interactions would have been more mindful on his end. I think definitely, again, one of the things, it's almost like a form of exposure therapy. I think he was not exposed to an African woman of color, especially American. and I think there's a lot of, America does a really great job of putting people into tropes. And mm-hmm. that one, unfortunately, mm-hmm. is a very significant one that crosses borders. So I think if he had been exposed to more of the Black Americans in America who actually are very, who have contributed, like, for example, Hidden Figures or like people who have been very scientifically or technically adept, I think he also would have changed. So I think something like this app would have definitely altered his behavior, because I don't think he consciously did it. He literally didn't think he was being treating me differently, which is crazy to me.
Yeah, I'm curious actually as to like if there are, I mean, I don't know who this, you know, professor is, or anyway, caveats aside, I'm curious as to like what his behavior would be towards just Americans in general as well. Like, I mm-hmm. wonder if part of that is like, you know, based on a lot of unconscious bias towards like Americans, because I don't know, I've been in Europe and there's a certain amount of I don't know. There's a certain thing towards Americans, right? When it comes to like, oh, they talk a lot and like they blow up things bigger than, you know, especially pitching ideas. Americans are known in Europe to be like talking bigger than what they have at the moment, I guess.
And that was very much my personality.
My only experience is in Germany.
Yeah.
Were there any other Americans in your class?
No, I was the only one. Every single person was actually from a different country. I think the most common group was, there was a group of, like, I think it was like five people might have been from China, but everyone else was from a completely different country. There were two white males, and we definitely saw, because as I was doing this project and doing this research, I had to give presentations after a while. So it was almost like educating them as well. So then the class would also start to see bias starts happening. And that was really fun for me towards the end of the course for them to notice when things happen. So we had two white males in the class, and one of them was from Netherlands and the other one was from Italy. And when we all pitched our projects for what we're going to actually build for our final exhibition, the Italian guy had came up and he had said he actually was made it very clear to the class that he had no interest in doing any lifting a finger for this project. He was checked out. He was working full time at a job that he already wanted. And when he pitched, the professor was like, he actually cited me and said, oh, why don't you be like Karama? Think big, do something. We'll fund your project. We'll help you build what you need to do something extremely huge. And he didn't offer that same amount to anyone else. He didn't offer funding anyone else's projects except for that one guy. The other guy, the one from the Netherlands, actually didn't even show up because he also got hired like at Google and was like kind of checked out as well. So it was just interesting to see like, oh, the only person who not only got encouraged and supported to do something big, but was on top of that was offered funding for his project, where all of us were like, wait, we all have to pay for ours. Why is he the only one getting this special treatment? And again, if you were to ask my professor, and if you were to tell me that my professor would do that, I would not have assumed that it was because he was a white male. I actually didn't even think about it, but it was something that we all reflected on and realized. And then because I was the course rep leader, I was voted by the class, I definitely rose it to his attention. I was like, it's not fair that you're offering him reimbursement for the cost of his project just because you want him to go big when all of us have to pay. And so you have to reimburse all of us as well. And then that actually ended up working out. But anyways, and so it was just like, that was actually really interesting to see. I was like, had we not have learned about this and had they not had understood it, if I were to say something about it, it would have been like, Karama, like whatever, it's because of XYZ, like whatever. But because other people in class were also be able to see and also say something, it all of a sudden became a valid thing that the professor had to make sure to correct and rebalance out.
It sounds like you were vocal about this, like at least to your classmates, that it, like, hey guys, I'm feel like there's something happening.
He actually mentioned it. He was like, why? He was mad. He was Italian, number one. So sorry to make that generalization. But they, I do have family that live in Italy and are Italian. But like, they are known to be angry and have no problem expressing that when they feel it. And he was actually really mad that he was being, quote unquote, forced to do something more than he wanted to do. And so he was expressing this to us. And that's how we found out that he was offered funding. And then so we're just like, wait, how come you were? And he's like, yeah, no, tell him, blah, blah, blah. Like, because he was trying to get out of it. So having his support, and then all of us also realizing like, oh, he was the only one offered funding and everyone had already done our things to him, to the professor, really just kind of, yeah, it became like, they were like, oh my gosh, like they were surprised to see that this is what it was. Like they were surprised. Like they were just like, hey, isn't this like your project? Like, oh my gosh, like we put to, like drawing the connection, like he's a white guy technically. Like, does that mean like, like, is that what happened? And they're like, how come none of us got like that same offer? And he didn't even go into it trying. Like, it's one thing if you went in there being like super ambitious and like, I want to do mm-hmm. something, then maybe they drew from that energy to support him. It's another when he literally had very like BS'd it and was still given that a support. Meanwhile, all of us who are really passionate about our projects, and me going hard with the VR after being lectured to for an hour not to do it because they didn't think I was going to be able to do it again, like didn't get any support. And it's awareness is definitely number one and very important to understanding how bias works. And that makes you, especially when it's unconscious, when things like that happen, you can ask the question, wait, did this happen because of this? Because this is what the science and research says is most likely to happen. Is that what happened? And how can we introduce measures to make sure that we can, they call them bias interrupters, to make sure everything's a little bit equal. Like, how do we ensure that if we promise something for one thing, one person, everyone has that same access? I'm not sure. Yeah. But yeah.
Yeah. Sounds like awareness is the first step towards.
Yeah.
You know, actually trying to push ourselves, like evolve through these parts of human behavior that I think we really should get beyond, you know, to get to the next step of human progress. I think there's these basic things that we need to at least start working on.
Yeah. And there's a lot of different triggers to bias. Like, it's not just race and gender at all. There's disability, there's height bias, like most age bias, weight bias. Yeah. There's so much beauty bias. Like women who are attractive are most likely to seen as less technical. And I see that a lot in Silicon Valley, unfortunately. And like, I just think there's so much out there that we don't realize we're making these snap judgments or decisions about each other. And what does that look like when we actually have power over them to give them a job or to interview them, to see them as credible, or to who do we decide to mentor? Like, you get what you see now, which is a homogenous culture that is only used to one type of worker. And therefore, as a result, when you're talking about innovation and research saying like diverse groups will always outperform homogenous groups that are experts when it comes to problem solving, what does that mean? What are we missing out on that we could have had if we had Silicon Valley be consistent of conformed to mostly diverse groups working on problem solving for the world? Like, how different would Silicon Valley be? And I don't know, it's something to really think about, I think.
Absolutely.
I think we'd probably not be the one part that I can see for Silicon Valley being different if the whole makeup of people was different. We'd probably be building products that are less geared towards just Silicon Valley. Like, I think there's a ton of the startup that do things because we're, you know, in Palo Alto or San Francisco, and it like can barely apply to the rest of the world. Of course, the ones that do end up doing really well, but like, there's a ton of just like, no, this is just like Silicon Valley or just California based.
I have a good example. So back a few years ago, LeapMotion, this great device and the great team we had multiple times here on the podcast, hadn't crafted their SDK so far that was track all their hands. And we were on exhibition and I programmed a quick demo where you can, you know, grab some stuff in our application. And I swear to God, none of the Asian hands were tracked. Like, the LeapMotion was just completely not working in the environment.
Have that training set.
Yeah, it's apparently they just trained it mostly for male hands, which makes sense. I mean, now I guess it's better, and I don't make any sense about the SDK right now. It was a very fresh device, you know, they just brought it out. They have a fresh SDK. I swear to God, like, none of the Asian hands and half of the female hands were just terribly tracked. And now I guess it's better, but it just takes time. And you have to, you know, be aware that there are different people. I mean, the same with VR headsets, right? Whether they fit your face or not, there are different faces. Like the Oculus Go, as I figured out yesterday, has a second foam that is for wider cheekbones or whatever. So they're apparently thinking in that direction. But I guess it's a young startup, you know, you have anyway, just white male team people. Yeah, just training with our hands should be fine. So, you know, it's just limits your device.
As in another, as an another anecdote that like is similar to that, there was a, I think a Korean research device that I was using that had a camera in the front to do like facial tracking to my mouth. But I had a pretty nice beard at that point. I like, you know, trimmed it in a month or two. And yeah, it just did not work at all. And I think they scanned my face as like, like, ooh, this is, we need to use this data because it wasn't that case, this isn't working. I was like, yeah. I'm glad I can help your research, man. Like, I'm sure there aren't that as many, you know, bearded people
and that's a problem with big data. That's a problem with big data. Yeah. As long as your sample size is huge but only not much diverse, well, you're training the algorithm to have a bias, and it's how it is, and we need to be aware of it.
Yeah, and the fun point to that, like for example, the Asian hands, for some reason it might not be tracking that, but it actually cross relates to other verticals. Like it's like, oh, it probably doesn't work in the dark. It probably doesn't work in like whatever factors. Mm. Like I as a UX designer, as an interaction designer, you learn about these things in terms of, and especially since I have to design for government services. Like if somebody, when you're designing for disability, like someone who doesn't have a hand, so they have to type with one hand. You're also designing for an able-bodied person who breaks their arm. And has to work with hand, or you're designing for a phone, which requires one hand. And so like, it's cross relates. It's not just like, oh, like for those people who don't have the moral inclination to care, but it actually also helps. Yeah. Or for example, the wheelchair accessible stuff. Like, yes, it's for people in a wheelchair, but also if you're traveling and you're carrying a lot of luggage, that's, you can use that same ramp versus having to take the stairs and carry your 100-pound bags. Like, or if you're on crutches, you can also use that. So it's like it cross relates to other types of use cases that all able-bodied people would eventually need at some
point. But it's not even about the body. It's also about relationship status. So, I mean, if you look at Apple devices, the iPad just has no multi-user support. So, I mean, a family gets an iPad and, you know, maybe you want to share it. Like an Android tablet, you can create special kids account, whatever. On an iPad, you just don't have it. Mm-hmm. So why is this decision? Why is it limiting their product so much?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, I think, because they know kids use, like, kids are one of the biggest users of iPad, and they have, like, parental controls for that reason, but like maybe it's a design decision to think to not split things and have parents have direct control over, you know, what apps their kids are using, but that's an interesting point. But yeah, no, I think in terms of accessibility, that was probably one of the most interesting, like, topics that I had the chance to take a course in university for, and I think that's like, as a like anyone that's a designer, I think should really get, at least have some kind of a basic understanding of when it comes to accessibility and like able-bodied like design, let's just say, because the only time you really realize these things in terms of how people use products and devices is when, let's say, like you break a leg and you have to use crutches. Suddenly, like all those doors in universities that you can press a button and the doors, you know, swing open for you, they just like stick out like a sort, you know, you see them everywhere. You realize like that's a huge part of design of places for accessibility. And that's not intuitive knowledge. I think it's not intuitive for a designer to really think of that. Similarly to like that, the yellow, if you're in America, there's typically like yellow bumpers on the crosswalks between like crossing intersections. And there's always like, you know, bumps on them. And if you're skating or if you're going on any kind of a thing, they're typically like, annoying. You don't like they're super annoying. You can't like get on and off a crosswalk. Turns out that it's actually meant for people that can't see very well, because you can feel like when you're walking, you can feel those bumps underneath your shoes. You can realize that that's towards the edge.
Yeah.
Right. Similarly to like a subway, right? Subway systems typically have that like yellow bumper layer that you don't cross. This is insightful stuff, I think, and VR seems to be a new tool that people are perhaps can use to teach people about cognitive biases. I think that's Yeah, if there's one thing that I want like my kids to grow up knowing is just cognitive biases from like the very young age, to understand that our thinking is not intuitive by any means, or truth, right? Objective truth is not intuitive by any means, and we've like evolutionary got to the point that we generalize to do everything. And
yeah, we
have generalize
understanding and what we
we have different experiences and whatever our exposure is to growing up, in terms of like if you grew up in a homogenous place versus a diverse place, a person who grows up in a diverse place is less likely to have these biases because they've been exposed to so much counter information that even if they did get fed stereotypical information through media, they have enough real world examples for their brain to know, okay, this is not a real pattern. But for people who grew up in a homogenous place and they see people that they haven't interacted with in the media and are fed stereotypes about them, then they're more likely to, their brain's going to draw a pattern. So when they do finally interact with someone in the real world, they might, their brain says, oh, here's the information that you needed to know about this person beforehand to help you navigate interacting with them. And then that, and since unfortunately most places in America are homogenous, that's what ends up happening unconsciously. So yeah, how do we go about, the real solution would be like, just be, everyone be diverse or grow up in diverse places, but that's realistic.
But there are some, solutions. There are some solutions like your application. Yeah. What I like about your approach, for example, is the fact that when I look at Germany or Europe, there are a lot of talks about, oh, we need more women in tech, or we need more diversity in tech. And okay, well, I'm working in a company, I'm trying to find people who work here. We don't have that many female applications. I'm thinking, okay, well, it's great to say we need more diversity, but you actually need to start in the school. You need to make sure that people don't fall out. I think the probability for someone to go into tech drops like from under school to university by 20% just based on their gender. And it's terrible because, well, those are skilled people, we are losing them. So starting in the school is exactly the right moment. I had like once this experience where I was visiting a school that is mixed, that has like normal, students and also handicapped students, right? And for me, as someone who has not many handicapped people around me when I was growing up, it's always, and I always reflected and I understand it, but it's always for me like, how am I approaching this person? Should I help him? Should I like treat him differently? But I saw those children and they were completely normal with that person. They were completely engaged with the situation. Yeah. For them, it's normal.
Yes.
And I guess when you start at school and you start early, we won't have those problems long term anymore when we actually don't, you know, cut off the ability of people to develop themselves, don't limit them to only very limited a certain amount of people. It actually gives them the ability to understand and learn different types, right?
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
So, Clarama, how can people reach you and find out more about your company?
Yes. Yeah, so you can follow us on Facebook at DebiasVR. You can follow us on Twitter at DebiasVR. You can contact us on our website, www.debiasvr.com. and if you fill out the contact form, it goes directly to my email. Also, you can just contact me, clarama@debiasvr.com. And just to clarify, Debias is spelled D-E-B-I-A-S. VR is VR. So,
there you go.
Yeah.
Cool. And you can find us on Twitter at ResearchVRcast and on Facebook, but let's not worry about Facebook.
Why are we not worrying about Facebook?
I don't know. Do you use Facebook?
I have to shame myself. I'm currently using it. I'm back on Twitter, so you can tweet at me and engage me on Twitter. So I'm going finally away from this big evil. Who knows if they're big evil or not? Recent news, you know, whatever. I understand it. Facebook has certain appeals. Twitter has certain appeals. Yeah, I am.
Facebook's great for events, though.
Yeah.
Nobody can beat that. In groups.
In the groups. I love the groups.
Yeah. But there's just junk. I feel like there's just junk notifications that.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that's been happening a lot. That's getting really. Yes, yeah. The junk notification, I think, is the biggest pain point for me right now. And I don't think it used to be like that at all. Mm-hmm. Like now, sometimes, now you can't even say, I don't want notifications like this anymore. Like, exactly. It didn't give me the option when I tried to, clean it out.
Right.
It's almost like an email where you're constantly getting spammed. That's interesting.
Yeah, there's no unsubscribe button. Oh, man. That's a good
like the opposite of Gmail, right? Gmail tries to cover everything that you don't want to see in some kind of spam folder.
Yeah.
And Facebook's like, oh, those important stuff, you don't need them. Let's show you the spam.
Yeah. It'll increase engagement. Yeah. Unfortunately.
All right, guys.
Yeah. Find awesome us, like us.
See it. Yes, Discord. Find us on Discord for... Oh, thank you. Thank you for our Patreon subscribers. And if you'd like to support the podcast the more, find us on Patreon to keep the lights on in this virtual room that we're sitting in. And thank you guys for listening, and goodbye.
Goodbye.